to the International House of Horrors.
Hello there, valued guests, and welcome back to the International House of Horrors, your sanctuary of spooky and the place for all things good, gory, horrible, terrible, brutal, and the macabre. I am one of your curators, Joe Merle.
And I'm Josh. Hi.
Hello, Josh. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I just had a long weekend, but now I'm on Sunday mode, relaxing a bit. How are you doing? You sound a bit sick.
Yeah, I'm recovering. I was really, really sick for a couple days. Yesterday was a little bit better. Had a chance to actually get out of the house a little bit. Went to a small, really small comic convention up north. It was the first one that they had done. So that was kind of fun. Met some cool people. Got a few things here and there, but still kind of recovering. And we've actually got Monday off for Labor Day. So even though today is Sunday, we still get tomorrow off. But other than being on the sick side, not doing too bad at all. You know, you live. As long as you're alive, that's a good thing. So other than that, good, man. And so you've been watching anything good lately? Any good horror you might recommend?
Not as many movies as I'd like to, but because I've been busy the last few weeks. But I've seen a few, and for one, I've actually got a small story. Because I think you told me before that Thoroughbreds is a great movie.
Yes.
Sorry. And so I went to see that movie in the cinema. And I thought, okay, I can't find anyone who wants to see a horror movie with me. So I'll just go on my own. Went to the cinema, bought my ticket, went to the room. They had the biggest room for that movie for that day because it just released over here. I went in, sat down, and waited. And the movie started and no one else showed up. I had the biggest auditorium all for myself to watch Thoroughbreds.
That's nice. It's like a private screening.
Yeah,
now,
exactly.
Was it marketed over there? Like, what does your marketing even look like in Germany? Like, do you guys get a lot of trailers on TV, or where does a lot of the marketing come from?
To be honest, I'm not too sure myself because I'm not... I don't watch any TV, so I never get any advertisements there. But we get advertisements on the radio. People talk about certain movies, and of course, in front of the movies in the cinema, you get them, and on YouTube, we also get lots of movie advertisement on YouTube these days. But I don't think I've heard anyone talk about Thoroughbreds other than on movie websites where I like. You talked about it on those movie guys, I think, and I've read about it on the internet, but
yeah, it was one because it released over here a long time ago, so yeah. it had been available for quite some time, and I did thoroughly enjoy Thoroughbreds. I thought it was great. I thought both the performances, Anya Taylor-Joy and who was it? Was it Olivia Cooke?
Yeah, exactly, Olivia Cooke.
Yeah, I thought they were wonderful, and for me, it was something that warranted I wanted to rewatch it almost immediately after seeing the ending. I wanted to see what else might have been, you know, little hints and things that might have been laid throughout the entirety of the movie. But what did you think about it as a whole?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I really enjoyed it. It was long and deliberately slow. Like, it didn't feel boring, but it was slow. And I could see lots of horror fans being turned off of it because not that much happens in it. But I really liked it, and I especially liked the sound design, which was awesome. And I enjoyed that movie a lot. I also already want to rewatch it.
I feel like it's worth it. You almost have to because there's so much. I felt that it wasn't super ambiguous at the end. I think it was pretty clear what had happened, but then at the same time, I'm like, wow, could it have been something just a little bit different, or were certain plot elements more relevant than I might have taken them for the first time around? You know, like the shot of a picture on a bookshelf, or something like that? Did it have more importance to the overall story? But I think that's one of the telltale signs of a good movie is if it makes you think. You know, all movies should make you think something, unless it's big dumb action fun. Then, but usually you know what you're getting when you go into that. You know, when you go into, but even with some of those, you think about, you know, Infinity War. I never assumed I would be thinking or kind of putting myself in the position of the villain and saying, hey, well, maybe his, you know, in his eyes, he's making the right decision. And logistically, his decision kind of made sense for some of these situations. Yeah. But with Thoroughbreds, I think there is a lot there to unpack. And I look for, I do own it. I ended up picking it up on iTunes. So I'm sure I'll revisit it.
Oh yeah,
at some point in time.
I actually, after I saw it, I thought I had a pretty clear picture in my head about this movie. And then I went to Reddit and read a comment thread on it. And there were so many different interpretations that I didn't even think about. And yeah, this movie doesn't feel like there's lots of interpretations, but there's so many different things you can see.
Right.
And yeah, so I really enjoyed that movie.
Oh, right.
The next, I think that's almost all horror movies I've watched. Other than just right before we started recording, I watched The Belko Experiment.
Oh, nice.
Because I actually wanted to see that for, like, I don't know, since I heard about it for coming out. James Gunn writing is always something I like. And so I always thought, should I buy it? Because I didn't get it in the cinema. So I thought, should I buy the DVD? I'm not sure. I haven't heard the greatest things about it. And then just a few days ago, I got it as a birthday gift. So I decided, okay, now I own it. Now I can watch it. And so I put it in, watched it. And it's enjoyable. It's fun. It's one where there's not that much to think about.
No, not at all.
Not like with... not like with Thoroughbreds. Like here, it's actually just for the fun and gore of the story. But I enjoyed it, and I'm a big fan of John C. McGinley ever since he did Scrubs. And so seeing him in this movie, he doesn't look a day older than he did in Scrubs, which was like ended 10 years ago, I think. So that's kind of crazy. And yeah, it's enjoyable. It's gory. It's they actually have some pretty nice effects going on there. And
no, it was
the
really
idea.
Good. It was one that I did get to see in the theater. So I saw it when it first released, and then watched it once after the fact. And I had mentioned to you it's very similar to Mayhem, but Mayhem is more of this virus, and this one is more of a... That's the only question you're really left with, is who's pulling the strings in the Belko experiment. Like, you could expand upon that universe and try and figure out, okay, who's the shadow organization behind all this fucking carnage and mayhem. But overall, you're right. The effects were really good. It was super gory. Like, there was...
Yeah.
And for those of you who might not know, if you're curious, it's just a bunch of people. And what country were they in? They were somewhere in South America or Central Mexico.
Yeah, I think Mexico, yeah.
Yeah, and so you have all these people that work at a satellite location for this huge organization, and out of nowhere, they're just all trapped in this office building and kind of given these ultimatums, like, if you don't kill somebody in 60 minutes, we're going to murder everybody. I don't remember if that was exactly it, but it's something along those lines. Like,
yeah, along those lines, yeah.
Yeah, you've got a few minutes to start killing each other, and so you have to watch these people who on the surface appear to be friendly and nice to each other, but you see them drawn and kind of disrobe down to their animal instincts in order to survive. But you never do get that conclusion about, okay, who exactly is doing this? And there could be room to expand upon this. I think even at the end, and maybe a little bit of a spoiler if you haven't seen it, skip ahead 30 seconds, but they made it appear that this is happening on a much grander scale. Like it's huge where it's going. It's not just isolated to this one individual building, but it was fun.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was kind of good.
It's totally fun. It's an enjoyable time, and you won't feel like you've wasted your time. Also, it's only like 48 minutes long. No, 84 minutes.
Yeah, I was gonna say not 48.
Yeah, it's only like 84 minutes, I think. So it's a quick and easy watch on the side,
which I think is
and
good for,
that's pretty much that's pretty much all I've been watching in horror in the last few weeks. So what have you been watching?
I just jotted down a couple things just to mention really quick. And the first up the other night, it was stormy out, and we've been getting a lot of really bad thunderstorms and rainstorms and things like that. And I was talking with Shayna while it was storming, and she said, "Well, what's a good movie that's got a good storm in it? Let's throw a good movie on while it's storming out." And I immediately was like, "Oh, Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives." Like, the thing opens up with a storm. You know, you've got the Tommy Jarvis character digging Jason up, making sure Jason's dead. This is the one where he stabs him with the wrought iron spike, and lightning hits it, because that's how you bring people back from the dead. You know, Frankenstein yeah. taught us that. The great doctor taught us how that's how it works. I watched Friday the 13th, 6, and I wasn't even going to write it down because I've seen these movies all so many times. But what I found interesting is that when I watch one Friday movie, I immediately fall down this rabbit hole. And I'm like, I just want to watch more and more and more. So over the course of like the last 3 days, I would say I've watched part 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. So 4, 5, and 6 is kind of, I think, some of the best Friday the 13th, and that's the Tommy Jarvis trilogy. Starts in part 4 with Corey Feldman, which is one of my personal favorites. But what I never understood about Friday 4 is Corey Feldman's only like maybe 9 years old. He's just a little guy. But this kid's a fucking special effects genius. Like,
yeah.
All these monsters he's got in his room and all this stuff. Not only that, but when her car breaks down, he's like, "Oh, it's probably the solenoid. We got to jump it." Like, he's also a well-versed mechanic. Like, Tommy is this great, just genius prodigy of a child. But I really like 4 in that it's when we, or not 4, but by the time we get to 6 is when we really start getting into Zombie Jason, which is my personal favorite Jason, when he does get brought back from the dead and he's got the maggots falling all over, falling everywhere off his face. And those are just great. I think it's something that I will always, even though they're not the best movies on the planet, I just have such a deep love for them that as soon as I watch one, I want to watch them all. Even though last night we watched Manhattan, and Manhattan's tough. Like, as I get older in age and hopefully a little bit wiser along with that, there's just some stuff in Manhattan that makes no sense whatsoever. It's just they got even more ridiculous from there. I'm a big fan of Jason Goes to Hell, but by the time you get to space,
that's the one I haven't seen yet.
So Jason Goes to Hell is really unique in that it was when the distribution and production switched from Paramount to New Line. So this is when New Line picked it up, and that's why, well, you've never seen it, but I don't think I'm ruining much because Freddy versus Jason already exists in the world. But at the end of Jason Goes to Hell, the mask is kind of out in this desert-type area. It's sitting on the sand, and you see Freddy's glove come up, and it grabs the mask and pulls it down. And as a kid, we were all like, "Oh, we're finally going to get it." You know, the end-all, be-all, Freddy versus Jason. Of course, it took like 20 years before the movie would ever come to light. So they really tried to do a whole new thing with Jason in Goes to Hell, in that he was almost a, I don't know, he could transfer bodies. He moves from one body to the other, so he's not just trapped in the traditional Voorhees body.
Oh.
Yeah, so he'll be like a waitress, but if she looks in the mirror, she'll see the reflection of Jason. There's a bunch of weird shit, and then you got this bounty hunter who's got a magic knife that can kill Jason, and then, of course, he ends up going to space. But one that I did want to bring up, because I'd never seen this, and I'm really bummed that it took me this long to see this movie. I ended up finding it on Shudder, so it might be on Shudder over there. You should see if you can find it, because I think you'd really enjoy it. And it's 1979's Tourist Trap. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Tourist Trap.
The name.
Yeah, the box art, I feel like I've seen a lot of times. And this, I'd say the biggest name in this one is Chuck Connors, who, for me, my dad, when I was a kid, would watch all these old Western TV shows, and he was the rifleman. And he was like this real good stand-up, you know, rifle guy. But in this movie, you got this group of friends that are driving down the road. The car breaks down. This guy's taking a tire to this kind of gas station. They end up on this roadside attraction that has been forgotten about due to a new highway being put in. You know, we've seen that story many, many times. Like, "Oh, the government put in the new highway. Now all my business is gone." But this guy ends up walking into this house, and out of nowhere, like, the house is full of mannequins. Like, weird mannequins, really creepy mannequins. And out of nowhere, all the mannequins start moving and laughing, and it, like, really, really bizarre imagery, but creepy in the best way possible. And I don't want to say too much more outside of that because it's a bizarre story. I'll give it that, but I thought they did a really good job in just creating creepy elements, especially for 1979. You know, we had some stuff, but it wasn't until, I would say, like Poltergeist and things like that where people... Because you get some, you know, just bottles flying across the room. And but this has so much to do with these mannequins. It's super bizarre, but it's a lot of fun. So if you get a chance, excuse me, all this talking, I'm drying my throat out. If you get a chance to see Tourist Trap, I highly recommend it. It was super cool. It's weird. And I can't wait to hear your thoughts on it because it is one. So hopefully it's on your Shudder over there. Because I know me and you have different things on Shudder. Like you didn't have Mayhem. Which Shudder was promoting for a long time, very similar to the Belko experiment. Yeah. And they even had like director, they had the director, a special spotlight commentary on Shudder with the director of Mayhem. But Tourist Trap, if you if you can get Tourist Trap, watch it for sure. Because it is a ton of fun.
I just looked it up and it's not available on Shudder. It's not available anywhere, but I can buy it on Amazon. So I'll probably... buy some more movies soon, and then I'll put that on the list for sure.
That is one that's worth owning. I would say it is. it's one that I don't know how I've missed up until this point, because it's a really good kind of B side of the track horror movie. But it was fun. And I did want
to. Sounds awesome.
I did want to talk today a little bit about after going to the comic convention yesterday, and when people think of horror, we traditionally think of horror. Movies, you know, you get some people who are, readers. You have your famous horror authors. You're a huge Stephen King fan. H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Allan Poe, Dean Koontz. A lot of these guys put out some great horror content, but I don't know how many people, read regularly all of this horror stuff. So I think comic books, it's just something I wanted to take a couple minutes to spotlight. Comic books in horror are really accessible. And I think there's some amazing content out there. And so I don't know how many of these you're familiar with, but I wanted to go through a couple of them just to and look at their contributions to the world of horror. Kind of not only some that are just standalone, but some that are the big ones that have contributed to horror cinema as we know it. And you can't have horror comics, of course, without the originals. And this is the EC Comics of the 1950s. Your Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, The Haunt of Fear. This stuff, if you can get your hands on it, now some of it to get the individual issues, because this stuff is so old, can get a little bit pricey, but a lot of it's available digitally. There's some great, great horror from the 1950s in comic book form, and I think it is worth checking out for sure. Some of the big ones that, there's one that I just recently finished reading called Harrow County. And for any other comic book people out there, there's going to be a ton of these that I'm going to miss. So if you have particular horror that you're like, oh, you got to read this, you got to read that, please email us. Let us know, because I'm always looking for a new horror comic to read. But Harrow County, it's kind of small town. I'm going to say the time period's like the 30s, like 20s and 30s. And it has to deal with a lot of like occults and witches and things like that. Like this witch was murdered all these years ago by the town people. But she, before she was even killed, she almost created half the town. They call them haints. And she created all of these people. And she eventually finds her way back. And again, I'm not going to get too deep into any of this stuff because I don't want to spoil it for anybody who might read it. But that's only 32 issues. So, and I think it's available in trade paperback so you can get it collected. But Harrow County, I love that kind of small town America where there's something nefarious. You have this, and there's a good balance of like good versus evil. And the Tyler Crook art is just beautiful. And even at the beginning, this isn't spoiling too much, but you have the girl who's kind of the protagonist in all of this. She's got this helper, her little friend, who's a boy with no skin. And so, but she at perfect. At some point she has his skin, and like skin is making these weird hissing sounds and talking a little bit. It's amazing. Another current one, a couple more current ones that I highly recommend is The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. So
I actually read one, or I think at least the first two
issues of
comics
it.
Of that. Yeah. Issues, that's the word, exactly, thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Because you told me to. You told me there were they were great, so I should check them out. So they're on, at least in Germany, you can get like the first six issues for free on Amazon Prime as to read online. So I've read the first two and I want to go on. I kind of forgot about them because then I got into Lovecraft and didn't have as much time to read. And they're awesome. And for anyone who doesn't know about them at all, like, there's Sabrina the Teenage Witch, I think is what it's usually known as. There was, I think, a TV series like with actual actors. Then I knew the Disney cartoon on television, which was all for children, of course. And this is the same story, just like a lot darker, a lot more realistic if you're talking about witches and witchcraft.
It's very, very dark. And this spawned out of, so Sabrina exists in the world of Archie Comics. And there's another series that kind of started this all called Afterlife with Archie. And we've had a lot of, Jughead, The Hunger, which Jughead's a werewolf, Vampironica has come out of this. But The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, even in the hard part with this is that you never know when the next issue is coming out. It's not consistent at all. I think there's only 9 or 10 issues out right now. But every issue has just been phenomenal. And even where we're at right now, I mean, it's dark to the point where her dad comes back as her boyfriend and like her dad's contemplating like, well, should I fuck my kid? Like really weird, dark things like that. And it's super bizarre, but it's really, really good. So I highly encourage you to finish that one up if you can, whatever issues you could find of that. And then any of the other, of all the Afterlife with Archie stuff, The Chilling Tales of Sabrina is my favorite. And we're getting the Netflix show that is going to be coming out, I want to say next year, early next year, summer next year, somewhere.
Oh, yeah, right.
And so I'm wondering how much of that they'll pull from this, you know, how dark they're actually going to make that show. And after that one, I wrote down Witches, but it's spelled W-Y-T-C-H-E-S. And this is by Scott Snyder, a very prolific comic book writer of the modern age. It has absolutely beautiful artwork, and it's a very short run. Everybody's kind of chomping at the bit, like, give us more witches. We need more witches. Everybody's waiting for more of this stuff. But again, it just deals with this family, I believe, it's been a while since I read it, but they moved away from town. I think it was like their kid was getting bullied or something like that. Well, this new town they end up in, there's clearly something evil living in the woods. But what sets this apart, like, even if you just pull up a couple pages on Google or anything like that, the artwork is just unbelievable. Like it's so just kind of chaotic, but this beautiful chaos all at the same time. The next couple I'm going to go through really quick, kind of some stuff that is a little more, I would say, once DC went over to the Vertigo side, we got Swamp Thing, which if you want more like the superhero horror, Swamp Thing is a great way to go. Hellblazer. So this is the John Constantine book, which the original run of Hellblazer, so good. But that deals more of the occult. It's not so much traditional horror, but very occult kind of magic. Marvel had The Tomb of Dracula. And then, of course, Robert Kirkman's The Walking Dead is, a global phenomenon. I think I stopped around issue, 155 of The Walking Dead. I was just done with it. But it is very good. And you can buy these huge omnibus collections of it that collects, 60 issues in each one. Yeah. So if you really want to read it, read it for Negan. Like Negan in the comic books is just amazing. But he's very
different. I've heard about these comics and I heard that at one point they're like resetting the whole story and like I'm not sure exactly what happens, but like at some way through the comics they just like kill everyone off and start a new comic series, basically. Is that something that happened?
Yeah, or... unless it happened after I stopped reading, because even when I stopped, you had a lot of your core characters were still there.
Okay, I think, I'm sorry. I think I've heard there's like some big thing happening at a certain point, and then everyone dies off and they start anew, basically. Which is like, it was like a big thing that happened, and I've heard about that, but I've never gotten into the comics. I've actually never really gotten into comics other than when I was a kid, I read the Mickey Mouse stuff.
Yeah.
And when I first got into horror, I actually, I don't even know where exactly I found those, but I found some comics of, I think it was Leatherface. There was like a run of Texas Chainsaw Massacre comics or something, where also they, I don't even remember what exactly I read, but I think there's somewhere they meet up with other slasher characters, and but I'm not too sure anymore. But I still remember reading those and being like, wow, that's crazy. That was before I even saw the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Texas Chainsaw movie. Yeah, that's actually and, what I was going to get into next, was the comics that have been, that have either, you know, movies have been made from them, or comics have been made based on these movies. So we've had comics, I mean, we've had Friday the 13th, we've had Halloween comics, which the Halloween one really hurts my heart, because they made two issues. It was supposed to be a three-issue miniseries. They never got the third issue out. So I've got the first two issues, but still kind of waiting for this, for the story to end. You've got Jeepers Creepers, Nightmare on Elm Street. There's a whole slew of Army of Darkness comics. Like all the, I want to say it's Dynamite puts out the Army of Darkness stuff, and there's like Ash versus, I mean, you name it, and there's an Ash versus whatever it might be. But the big one that you might not, and even Hellboy. I mean, Hellboy was a comic long before he was ever a movie character. Even though he's not traditional horror, he's still a demon, and you have these demonic elements. But the big one that I think not a lot of people might not be aware of is that the manga, which, you know, for a lot of people is Japanese comics, is actually the Guinea Pig, Flower of Flesh and Blood, and Mermaid in a Manhole were both manga before they were ever made into a movie. Yeah, and those are super disturbing. For those of you who don't know the Guinea Pig stories, they're on every list of what's the most fucked up thing you could ever watch. You almost always end up on Guinea Pig. And we've had Silent Hill comics, like you said, Texas Chainsaw. And then Alan Moore, you know, before it was ever a movie, From Hell was a graphic novel. So the Johnny Depp, Jack the Ripper story. And so in a lot of ways, they'll take these characters that you really like and translate them over into a comic format. And so you can get more of the people that you like. And depending on who's drawing it, you get some awesome artwork along the way. Those are the few that I had, even though, like I said, there's probably a ton more. There's only a couple more that I wanted to mention. And the next one up is called Crossed. And for a lot of people, Crossed is one of the most fucked up comics you could read. Like, visually, it's just, it's nuts. And it deals with this world where this pandemic takes place all over the world. You're kind of following a group of survivors, but what the pandemic has done, like this virus, has made people, all they do, they pretty much just carry out any of their evil thoughts. Like whatever kind of sick, twisted thought they have. So you'll have these huge panels, these huge pages of just like orgy of violence. And I mean, so it's just like people having sex all over while murdering each other at the same time. And it's all very, very clear in front of you. Like it's brutal in every single way. So if you're looking for something super brutal, Crossed is the way to go. And then Outcast by Robert Kirkman as well from The Walking Dead is a lot of fun. It deals with like demonic possession. But it's weird because like your main character, kind of demonic possession tends to follow him around. Like wherever but he's trying to figure out. He's like gets involved in this demonic underworld and the stuff that's happening there. And then the last couple are two that I have not read, but I heard are absolutely amazing. And that's Lock and Key, which is written by Joe Hill. So for those of you unfamiliar, Stephen King's kid has actually done a lot of cool comic book work. And after that is Nailbiter, which I've heard nothing again but good things about Nailbiter. And it deals with this one small town in Oregon that, like, I forget how many, like 19 serial killers or something ridiculous have all come from this same small town. And so they're trying to figure out what is it that's producing all of these psychopaths. And on the very last side of things, and I wrote this down because I actually picked up a couple of issues yesterday. You have Boris Karloff, Tales of Mystery, and The Twilight Zone, which were really cool kind of companion pieces to the... And I love the Twilight Zone books in that at the beginning of every issue, you get, you know, Rod Serling doing an introduction to the... So you can kind of read it in his voice, you know, what's going on. Yeah. And I think you get like four stories in each issue of the book, so it's... It's pretty cool. And yeah, I just wanted to touch on all those really quickly in that don't limit your horror just to, you know, one medium. You know, don't limit it just to movies and TV. There's also some great horror books and horror comic books out there. So be sure to check some stuff out and let us know what you think. Let me know what your favorite horror comic is, because I'm always looking for some new horror book to add to the list and start reading. And then I can't wait for you to finish up the Sabrina.
I've got a question about this Crossed.
Yeah.
Because, that sounds totally like my thing, and I just looked it up, and there seems to be something called Crossed Plus 100 by Alan Moore, and just Crossed by Garth Ennis.
Yeah, so Garth Ennis was the original one, and that's where you'd want to start, and then there's these other kind of stories that follow. So you'd want to start with just Crossed, and you probably really would like it. It'd be right, but I'm sure it's banned in Germany. Because everything's banned in Germany. But you would want to start with just the Crossed title is where you would want to start.
Okay, I'm going to look that up later because that sounds awesome. And I've got one more comic I wanted to ask you about.
Oh, yeah.
Because you brought up the Nightmare on Elm Street comics, the Friday the 13th comics. You brought up the Army of Darkness and the Ash versus comics. But you didn't mention, like, that is the big one I've heard of that I can't find over here. But it's Freddy versus Jason versus Ash.
Yeah.
Have you read that?
I haven't read it. No, I haven't read it. So some of that stuff, it with some of these horror comics, especially the licensed stuff, it's not like your Marvel or DC. They don't do these huge print runs. You know, it's usually not Marvel or DC putting this stuff out. Your two kind of powerhouses in the world of comics. I mean, Image Comics I would put in there with Marvel and DC now as far as publishing power. But some of this stuff, the runs were so limited, the number of prints that they did. So even to get your hands on one is going to cost you a couple bucks. Now, granted, we have digital format that is now available. I don't do a ton of digital comics. I prefer to have the paper in my hand. There's just something about the experience of holding it. But for a lot of these, I mean, even like to get those couple Halloween issues right now, you're probably paying, you know, $25 a book or $30 a book. They're not super cheap, so it is an investment to get your hands on it. And if it was never translated over to digital, then you've got to find those hard copies. But yeah, like I said, they did everything with Ash. Like, you name it with Ash, and they did it. They really capitalized on the Evil Dead. And some of those Evil Dead comics are fun. I've got a couple of runs of those that I read that are a good time if you like the Ash character. But I'll keep my eyes open. If I find one, I'm sure I'll pick it up. Yesterday, I was just hunting for old Batman back issues, but unfortunately couldn't find any. So, yeah, that's horror comics in a nutshell. So let me know if you find Crossed, because I'd be interested. I mean, it really is just a fucking nightmare. Like, the stuff that
they have lots of them on Amazon. So I just got to find where exactly I start, because there seems to be like different volume ones of Crossed. So I'm going to look into that later.
Yeah.
But it's all like 16 to 17 bucks. So I'm probably going to buy one soon and just check it out.
Oh, yeah. Because those would be like your trade paperbacks, the collection of quite a few issues.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. And I found one Ash versus Freddy versus Jason on Amazon. Freddy versus Jason versus Ash, but you can only buy it used for €888.99, include plus €3 shipping. So it's no idea. Probably just out of print. And
a lot of that stuff, like I said, the print run was so low that it makes it scarce, and it's a lot harder to. To come. And even some of the like earlier issues, the nice thing about if you want to get into like Swamp Thing or Hellblazer or any of the more modern stuff, almost all of it's collected in trade paperback, so it's much more accessible. You can actually buy and walk away with
it. So I think now it's time to get into the second topic for the episode, which is I had the idea. I love looking at horror lists and finding new horror movies or seeing lists of movies that I have seen and just saying like, okay, yeah, this totally belongs on here, or saying this is shit. And so I found this IGN list. IGN does lots of different stuff and also lots of lists.
Yeah, and I think put IGN a lot of thoughts is, I think it's Internet Gaming News is what the IGN stands for.
Yeah, I think that's officially where they come from, but they preached out a lot.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and so They put a lot of thought into a top 100 horror movies list. And I haven't looked it all through because I want to get some surprises as well. But I flew over it and saw a few titles and I thought, okay, this might be interesting. And they judged with three criteria. On the one hand, if it actually wants to scare viewers, on with jump scares, with psychological menace, with atmosphere, or any other means, if it actually is scary. Also, if it's grounded by human fears of the unknown or anything else. And also, if it has any cultural or historical significance for the horror genre, or if it's innovative in some way. And that's okay. How they made a top 100. And of course, we're not going to read a whole 100 movies right now. But I think what we want to do is, like, every now and then we'll pick up the list again and go 10 to 20 movies through it to see how much we can do, how much we know, what we think about these movies.
And I just jotted down a note on my book. I'm going to write down the movies I haven't seen. So I'm curious as to how many out of this list of 100. I'll keep coming back to this page and look at how many I may not have seen.
That's actually a good idea. I'm going to do that as well. And we'll see how many we've actually not seen. And I said before, when I sent you the list, I think combined we've seen all of them.
Right.
But I already know that, like, the second movie on this list, the number 99, I haven't seen, and so I hope you have seen it.
Got it. Well, why don't you kick it off, and we'll because I opened the link that you had sent me, but then I just closed it almost as soon as I opened it because I was like, well, I'll let it be a little bit of a surprise. I want to see what the movies are. So I'll let you go through the list, and then we can kind of talk through as you go.
Okay, yeah. So the number 100 of the best horror movies of all time is 2002's The Ring by Gore Verbinski, which I agree that this – we put Samara on our, I think, second-tier horror villains,
yeah,
or even the first. I'm not sure, yeah. But she's and The Ring, when I was in school, and that movie was already out for a few years because I was already a bit older. And I've heard girls in my class say, like, oh, we've watched The Ring. That's the scariest movie ever.
Yeah.
And it is actually really scary and really well done. And it totally belongs on this list. What do you think about The Ring?
It's so I had a similar experience. So when The Ring came out on DVD, I worked at a video store. And I remember it was around Halloween time, and this group of young girls came in with their mom, and they were talking to the other guy I was working with, and they asked him, they're like, hey, we want to see something super, super scary. And so the other guy knew I was a horror cat, and he's like, well, go talk to him. And so they come up, and we walk over to the horror section, and I'm listening to him talk about stuff, and they're like, what's the scariest thing you could ever imagine? And I said, okay, well, I got some ideas, you know, my brain's going, like, what could I possibly give these kids? And so I asked them, I said, what's the scariest movie you've ever seen? And they immediately said The Ring. And I was young and kind of an asshole at the time. And I was like, well, if that's the scariest thing you've ever seen, pick anything, because you'll probably be scared. So, but at the time, looking back, it definitely was a creepy movie. You know, the imagery of Samara coming out of the well. And I think even when we talked about her as a character, for me, it was always that twist in the movie where the kid's like, you let her out? Like, what did you do? How could you possibly let her out? You fucking lunatic. What is this? I thought that was a great turn of events for the movie. And I think it was just, I mean, before The Ring, we hadn't had many people attempt to translate Japanese horror into an American context or into an English context. Because for a lot of people, Japanese horror is very different. You know, the ghosts and the demons, it's a very different feel. You have to go into it knowing exactly what you're going to get. But with The Ring, they did it pretty seamlessly. And it was just that creepy imagery of Samara and the art house film that they watch. And this idea of it's, you know, almost Final Destination-esque or A Nightmare on Elm Street, where it's an evil that you can't get away. You can't run. Like, it's not Jason or Michael. You can't run far enough away to where they can no longer get you. This thing's going to follow you wherever you go. And I think it really was just the Samara coming out of the television, you know, the hair and the creepy, like, weird walking that made it a pretty scary movie. But I do believe it deserves to be on the list. Because by that time, I had seen so much horror. I started with horror very, very, very young. But for a lot of people who aren't horror junkies, you know, that stuff is creepy. It is scary. So I think it does deserve to be on the list.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is like one of those for everyone, like for the wide masses. This was a box office hit, I think.
Yeah.
Like everyone went to see it. And what I think is the scariest part about this movie is the video.
Yeah.
The video that the people watch, because that is actually something you could be afraid of. Like, and it's a great psychological trick they played, right? They make you watch this cursed video and you watch it in the movie, and then afterwards you hear it's cursed, you know, that's the cursed video. So you're tricked by thinking, oh no, now I've seen the cursed video, and the video in itself feels like it's like
it's weird. So it's surreal, just like pictures of weird. A horse and a ladder, and it's just a bunch of weird, like I said, it's like a student film. Like, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Like somebody first year of film school.
It's almost like David Lynch made that video.
Right, yeah. Been a lot cooler if he did.
Yeah, my biggest problem with this movie was that before I've seen it, I already saw Scary Movie 3, which was mocking it to death.
Got it.
And so when I watched The Ring, every time, now I finally got the references Scary Movie was making. So to me, that movie was funny in certain ways because of all the of all the jokes I knew about it. Let's get to the next movie, which I know nothing about really, and I haven't read the description they put down here because I haven't really looked into the list. But this one is from 2000, directed by Tarsem Singh, and it's called The Cell.
Okay.
Do you know about this?
Yeah, J Lo. It was Jennifer Lopez,
is it J-Lo?
Right?
Okay.
Yeah,
that might be okay.
The Cell, that's always been a weird one for me, and it's a very I don't want to say it's polarizing because I don't feel it is, but for a lot of people, it's not super accessible because it's very weird in its imagery, but it's sci-fi horror. It's not traditional horror. Now, granted, it's been years since I've seen The Cell. I watched it a few times when it was first released, and I just remember it. She becoming this, I don't want to say she was an overlord, but I remember her becoming this kind of monster character. But I do recall a lot of sci-fi elements. It's something I'd have to go back and rewatch. But I know there are a lot of people who really enjoy it. But at the time, it made me think, it's not like space sci-fi, but there's science fiction elements to this movie, if I remember correctly. So it is something, but it was never something that resonated with me to the point where, oh, this gets added to my list of great horror movies. And I mean, one, I think Jennifer Lopez, she's a fine actress, but I don't think she's, you know, a star in the same sense. When it comes to horror, I just don't think of her in that horror role. But I do remember enjoying it. So maybe it's something I'll go back and watch it and see if there's maybe something I missed, or after years later, it holds more relevance than it did at the time. Maybe I was too young to really get it.
Yeah, I'm really interested in it. Like I said, I know nothing about it. I just saw like some. It's also not a movie many people talk about. Like I've heard the name thrown in, The Cell.
Yeah,
I've heard that name, but I don't have any connection with it. I didn't know Jennifer Lopez was in it until you just said it. And what I just read there at the "Did you know" parts is that there's a scene based on and designed by H.R. Geiger.
Oh, nice.
On a painting by H.R. Geiger. So that's always interesting because he's great and
right.
Does scary
is
things.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, he basically designed
the xenomorph.
Yeah.
He's very like biomechanical, sexual in his art style. And he not only did paintings and things, he did furniture. And I mean, he's one of a kind. Like, truly, if you see a piece of artwork, you know it's Geiger. You can say that's Geiger artwork right there because he was so unique in his style.
Yeah, exactly. So off to the next movie, number 98. And this is one where I'm not even sure if everyone would count it as a horror movie. And it's from 2010, directed by Darren Aronofsky, and it's Black Swan.
Okay. And this is another one where where's the line between horror and psychological thriller? Now, Black Swan, I think, is horrific in its imagery. And this was Best Picture, right? Was Black Swan Best Picture? Nominated. I know it was at least nominated.
Nominated.
Yeah.
I looked. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so Black Swan, I think is terrifying in that some of the imagery where you get the actual the swans and like the people transforming into these humanoid type bird monsters. And but really it's the psychological component and getting into Natalie Portman's head. And Aronofsky, if you're unfamiliar with his work, he tends to be a little more, especially in his more modern work, it does tend to be pretty ambiguous and it's open to interpretation. Like, what do you believe was truly happening with, you know, Mila Kunis and Natalie Portman? The same way with Mother, you know, what do you believe truly happened with this stuff? He lets the viewer experience it in a way where it's thought provoking and they have the opportunity to kind of dig in and, well, I saw this or I saw that, which is a great hallmark of a good filmmaker, is if you can create a conversation around your film, but then sometimes that can work against you where people are like, well, that's just fucking weird for the sake of being weird. You know, you think of stuff like, yeah. You know, as much as you and I both love Eraserhead, Eraserhead's a weird fucking movie that people have been arguing about for years since it was released. But with Black Swan, it is, in my mind, a psychological thriller with horrific elements that I think creeps people out. And there is something very scary about the human mind when it breaks, when it snaps.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, so I looked it up. This one best leading actress for Natalie Portman.
Okay.
She won an Oscar, but the movie was just nominated for Best Picture.
Got it.
And I'd say it's a horror movie, but we know that I take the line a bit differently than do you do. it's just a great movie, and yeah, it's you're getting into the mind of Natalie Portman's character. And she's going crazy and you're going crazy with her. And for the longest time, you don't really know what's going on until the end.
Right.
And so it's a different horror, but it's I really enjoy it. And it makes you feel weird.
Yeah, it does. It definitely makes you feel. Aronofsky almost always makes you feel. I was talking to Shayna last night. We were flipping through movies and she had never seen Requiem for a Dream. And I said, man, if there's one thing that'll make you feel, and that was one when I was, you know, a teenager and first kind of getting into the more obscure stuff. And that was one I feel like we passed around and everyone was like, you never seen it. Oh, you got to see this movie. And so to me, Requiem could be considered a horror movie, like the horror of real life, the horror of drug addiction. Never has drug addiction been painted so clearly on a canvas as with. And that score. That score is so good.
Yeah, that score is awesome. And horror movie worthy is at least that scene with the fridge.
Oh, yeah.
Where the fridge is attacking the mother. I think that alone is a horror movie in its own.
Yeah, yeah.
And there probably is a horror movie with a crazy fridge that's going rogue.
What always got me is when he's like, he has to shoot up the heroin into the arm that's all fucked up and festering and, you know, abscessed. And he's like, I won't even feel it if I put it in my other arm. You got to do it in this one. And you see that needle just go into that pussy wound. Ugh, brutal, man.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Oh, no. Okay. Let's get to the next movie on the list. And this one is for sure a horror movie. From 1992, directed by Bernard Rose, it's Candyman.
Yes.
Starring Tony Todd.
The great
Tony Todd. This is a horror movie.
Absolutely. I mean, he's, you know, we talked about him. I think he was on our second tier list. Or maybe he was even, I think second tier. I think we had put him on
I think so, yeah.
Because he is very, very creepy and, you know, stems from the idea of Bloody Mary. I don't know if you guys had Bloody Mary or something similar when you were kids where you say the name three times in the mirror. You say but Candyman was
even
the same
Bloody
way.
Mary here.
Yeah, Candyman was the same way. You know, this idea of kind of an urban legend where you speak him like Beetlejuice. You speak him into existence. But Tony Todd, is just a genre icon. Like, as an actor, you know, he's done it. And he's a very demanding presence whenever he's on screen, which I think lends himself well. But unlike a lot of other horror slasher-type villains, is you see his face the whole time. He's not masked. He's not cloaked. He just has that big jacket on.
Yeah, he's like a pimp. Like
right, holding in all the bees. Like, he's full of bees. And he had a hook for a hand. But Candyman, absolutely, is a horror movie.
Yeah.
And you had, what was the sequel? Farewell to the Flesh, I think.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the sequels yet. I've only seen the original. And I think the original is much more psychological than I think the others go. Like, you're actually if I remember this correctly, the first movie actually ends like, or has you thinking all throughout, is Candyman real, or is it all just in her head, in the main actress's head? And so he's there, even in this article, they put him on a list with Freddy, Jason, and Michael Myers, which he's an iconic character, but I wouldn't count him as a slasher villain.
Right.
At least not after seeing the first movie, right? So that's where it gets. But it's a horror movie for sure, but more psychological than slasher, I think.
Right. No, I'd agree with you completely.
Yeah. And so we're at number 96, a movie that should be much higher on this list, at least if you're asking me, because it's from 1992, directed by Peter Jackson.
Brain Dead.
And it's Brain Dead, a.k.a. Dead Alive.
Yes. And this is one, which is, I mean, we've done whole episodes about this, so if you really want to hear our thoughts on this, but I do agree with you, and we can leave it at, it should have been higher up on the list. Not only just because it's a fantastic movie, but just the boundaries that he pushed with this movie. You know, the...
Yeah, talking about being innovative and...
Right. The bloodiest movie of all time.
Yeah, I'd say it's even influential in some parts. I think this movie helped the over-the-top horror comedy to get where it's at today.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, let's because we've talked so much about this, let's right jump to the next. Number 95, a 2007 classic by now, directed by Michael Dougherty. It's Trick or Treat.
Yeah. Which is a personal favorite of mine. It is
mine as well, yeah.
It is one of the few movies that truly feels like Halloween. Like, they captured the aesthetic and what makes Halloween so special to so many people. And a successful anthology horror, which, you know, a lot of times anthology doesn't work out all that great. I love it. I'm a sucker for it. But in a lot of anthology, you'll get, you know, like if I was to name some of my favorite anthology, like Creepshow, Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side, Trilogy of Terror, any of that stuff, I almost always gravitate towards one story. Like, there's one really, really good one. And then, you know, maybe one that is not good at all, or even with the more recently, like VHS or the ABCs of Death is just, I mean, there's a few good, but there's so many shorts in there. It's hard to pick just a couple. But with anthology, I've always found it that, you know, you like one or the other. But with Trick or Treat, I like every single one of those stories equally. And just the introduction of Sam. I think Sam is one of the most likable little horror villains of all time, because the dude really is the spirit of Halloween, where if you don't give him what he wants, he gets a little violent, he gets a little crazy, but he just wants to celebrate Halloween, and that's his thing. But Trick or Treat, to me, should be higher on the list. 95? Wow, it should be way higher.
It should be higher, yeah. I'm wondering what's coming up in the other, on the rest of the list.
Yeah.
But because... all these movies are pretty good so far, I'd say. But yeah, a Trick or Treat. I think what helps this anthology is that it's all directed by the same guy. So like he had something in mind when he made this, and I think that really helped having this be one good movie with all good segments. And the little guy, we almost put him on our first. Greatest horror icons, because he's just awesome. And I think that movie that had, like, I remember I've listened to a horror podcast that started in 2007, and they talked about hearing about this movie, but I think the official release was in 2009, because they couldn't find any
distribution
exactly. And so that's crazy to me, because this movie is great. I've watched it the last two Halloweens. I'm going to watch it next Halloween as well.
I watched it like last month. I watch it probably five, six times a year. I do always watch it around Halloween, but it's something to me that's just, it's just so good from start to finish. I think it's, and I did have, I hate to cut you off, and I apologize for that, but
no
I was
problem.
Talking to a friend of the show this morning, and... He actually put something on here, and I told him we were going to be kind of going through a top 100 list, And this is this came from Michael, and he says, tough to gauge top 100 because the culture changes and what scares the culture changes. Original Dracula had people taken out on stretchers for potential heart attacks, and today movies like Saw happen, and we are like, arterial spray pattern would have been different if his head was just taken off that way. And I think he's really onto something there in that, you know, what scares people and the idea of what scares you. So it's always hard to quantify a list. And I'm with you in that I enjoy going through these lists. But what scares one person might not scare the other person at all. Everybody kind of has their subgenre of what truly, truly creeps them out. But thank you, Michael, for sending that over. Because,
thank you.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But Trick or Treat, yes, it's an absolute must for me. That one and Tales of Halloween I really enjoy as well as an anthology horror.
Halloween. Halloween was one you recommended to me, and I watched it, and it was fun for sure. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I loved the little the segment with the space alien and the serial killer with the little alien goes into her body, and they have that. Anyway, go ahead. 94. Yeah,
94 is one that I would personally put further down on the list even, but also, I don't know, I don't like where recently horror is going. So this is a 2013 movie directed by James Wan. It's called The Conjuring, which it is very, like, it basically started the ghost genre again in modern horror. And it is scary and it is well done. And I remember before the movie came out, there were all these articles like, this is the scariest movie ever. And people were like having their heart rate tested during the movie and showed that it was crazy. I still remember that, and I saw it when it came out. And but I think it also helped get all these movies, these teenage horror movies with just jump scare after jump scare, which really annoy me. But it is an influential movie, and I like this one at least. This was fun. I didn't like Conjuring 2 as much because what was new wore off by then, but it is a good movie in the end. The Conjuring, and it changed the culture. It changed how horror films are made by now. What do you think of The Conjuring?
I absolutely love The Conjuring, and okay. I'm just a big fan of James Wan in general. I think the dude has a, you know, even he'll always be hailed as, you know, the creator of Saw. He kind of started two genres, like the torture porn. Yeah. He kind of brought that in, which Saw's so interesting, though, in that, you know, he made Saw out of budgetary restrictions. They were like, you know, when you read about him creating this, and he said, well, how do we make a whole movie in one room to where we don't gotta be traversing the globe or being even outside? We can just very, very low budget. But with The Conjuring, and even before The Conjuring, which I'm sure we'll run into on this list, the first Insidious movie. So The Conjuring, now we're in this... We live in a place where we have this Conjuring universe, is what we're calling it. Yeah. But The Conjuring, for me, Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, I thought were absolutely amazing as the Warrens. And what James Wan does really well, or his casting director, I don't know who is responsible, is all of those girls in The Conjuring were so believable. And that's hard to get five kids, you know, that can act and make you believe that they're... Because a lot of horror movies, when you get kids in it, if their performance isn't spot on, it immediately pulls you out of the movie. And you're right with the jump scares. But I think the thing that creeped me out the most about The Conjuring wasn't even a jump scare. It was when they were in the basement near the end and you see the face of the witch kind of underneath that bag or whatever they had on her head when they've got her tied to the chair and they're going to perform the exorcism. But you're right. There is some... But he, I don't know, even with his jump scares, some of them not being jump scares, he just has a way, like the ambiance of the whole thing just gets like gets under your skin and you feel like you're in this twisted, dark place.
I agree. And his jump scares aren't bad. Just what followed his jump scares is what really annoys me.
Right.
This movie was good. I remember the that scene where they're like... I've only watched it in 2013, so I'm not I don't remember everything, but I still remember there's this scene where they are playing like this game where you clap,
game.
and then the others try to look for you, and then there's these hands either in the
They come out from behind her. They exactly. They clap out of the because she thinks she hears her kid in the armoire, and she goes to the armoire, and then she ends up getting like hearing something in the basement. The door slams behind her, and then you see the hands. She's like lighting matches one after another, trying to fit, and her hands shaking, and you've got this light, and then the hands come out from behind her, and you hear that clap, and it's very creepy.
Yeah, exactly.
And I like the second Conjuring quite a bit. I was a fan of I like just the Ed and Lorraine Warren characters, and I'm very excited. Next week, we've got The Nun coming out over here, and I'm really excited to see that movie. And in The Conjuring 2, there's a great scene. Have you seen The Conjuring 2?
Yes, I have.
So I absolutely just love the sequence, and it still gets under my skin, where he's in the room with the nun painting, and you see the shadow moving across the wall, and then it slowly gets behind that painting, but all you can see is those eyes and just a little bit of white. I think he just creates great, creepy characters. He does it, even the crooked man, you know, it's a weird, weird character, but I enjoy that stuff. I like it a lot. But I'm with you. I think The Conjuring should be a little bit higher up on the list.
So next up, we got this one. This is kind of the first one that's preaching a bit out. We're now in 1958, directed by Terence Fisher. It's Horror of Dracula, which is Christopher Lee. Christopher Lee Dracula. Yeah. And I actually got to say, I'm not sure right now if I have seen this.
I think
I have, but with these Hammer Dracula movies, I've seen one or two, but I don't remember which ones. I'm just going to look that up. What do you think of this movie?
I like Christopher Lee as Dracula. I'm a huge fan, and I'm with you though in that there were so many Hammer Dracula movies. Like they put out just back to back to back to back. Once they realized they could use that character and not have to pay any of the licensing or anything like that, they just ran with it. But I would encourage people, if you've never seen a Christopher Lee Dracula film, that Horror of Dracula is a great one. He plays a really, really good Dracula. And he's just a great character, you know, in general, character actor, going from Dracula to Star Wars. The dude is just Lord of the Rings. You know, he was one of the spotlights, the highlights of Lord of the Rings. But his Dracula and the Hammer films in general are very different. They have that, you know, European Gothic horror element that lends itself super well. Whereas before this, you had, you know, Dracula on a soundstage. This stuff, it just feels more a lived-in world than some of the stuff that had come before it. So I think it definitely deserves to be on the list.
For sure.
Now, I don't know if we need any more Hammer movie, Dracula movies on the list after this one. But I think this is the one where, you know, you got to give the credit where the credit's due for bringing Dracula to life one more time on the screen.
And also, this is where we got Van Helsing as... the other way around. This is where we got Peter Cushing as Van Helsing, right?
Yeah.
There was also this... Because he's also a great Van Helsing. And I just read this little... Did you know this little fact? This movie was originally titled just Dracula, but they changed the name in America because the Bela Lugosi film was still regularly playing in theaters.
Wow.
In 1958. And that's funny. And I'm now going to the next movie because we both agree this is, I think this movie is not as scary anymore as it is just really well done and really influential, right?
Right.
That's probably it. This is like 58, so also this was like the start. Like they started something completely new with this gothic horror, but they went kind of gory. They showed more cleavage than usually because. When I think of the 50s and 60s, I still think of like Psycho, where there isn't really anything happening on screen because they didn't show that stuff. But on the same time, 58 had already Dracula going completely crazy for the time.
Right.
So next one that I'm actually surprised to see on this list because for the longest time, this was hated, I think. It's from 1982. Directed by Tommy Lee Wallace, it's Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Yeah.
This is a movie I actually wrote an article about this when I wrote for iHorror, where I wrote, why this isn't a bad movie, because there's still lots of people who watch the Halloween franchise and then say Season of the Witch, that makes no sense, it doesn't fit with Michael Myers, and they hate it.
And but, it's so interesting in that people, because it's a great standalone horror movie.
It's awesome.
Like it, yeah. It's, yeah, it's, and you have this amazing score, and even that the Silver Shamrock song, like 8 more days till Halloween, 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 Halloween. 8 more days till Halloween. That's perfect. You had the score there, but at the time they didn't know they were almost going to take that Halloween name and start doing like an anthology style filmmaking. They didn't plan to continue on with the Michael Myers.
And I actually think that's a great idea. The title is Halloween.
Right.
They should just, and yeah, and I'm not sure. I haven't seen any of the others. Are there many more great Halloween movies like the first one, or do you think it would maybe have been better if they stopped with Michael Myers and just did an anthology series?
Now, I'm biased. Like I'm such a Michael Myers fanboy that no, give me as much Michael Myers as possible. But and for a lot of people, you know, for Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers is a fan favorite in the series, which in my eyes, it's a great movie as well. The 4, 5, and 6 are kind of the Jamie Lloyd trilogy. So it's Michael Myers' niece where you're dealing. Danielle Harris plays her in part 4 and 5, and then you get a small appearance in part 6. Halloween 7, for a lot of people, is their favorite Halloween. I've talked, you know, that was when Miramax took it. I want to say it was Miramax distributed. Maybe not. Maybe it was still just Dimension. Or maybe it was only Dimension, but that was the return of Jamie Lee Curtis. But it was more in line with things like Scream and Urban Legend and these movies, kind of these, you know, teen, they were marketed more towards a teen audience than they were towards a true horror audience. But, you know, just looking at Season of the Witch, because it doesn't have Michael Myers, does not make it a bad movie whatsoever. It's a great movie. And the masks are perfect. Like, I love those creepy masks. And the idea that, you know, you're brainwashing the entire youth at one point. Like, make sure you're in front of your TV, kids, at 9 o'clock. And that's a really terrifying sequence when we actually see the kid and his head get all sucked into the mask. And there's maggots and bugs and centipedes and all these insects falling out of the mask. It's one that I watch a lot. And I shouldn't say a lot. There's certain movies I watch probably once a month, but this is one that that maybe I'll even watch it today now that you've mentioned it, because the sound design is amazing. Those like deep like synthetic sounds like doo-ding-dong-dong-dong-dong-dong-dong-dong-dong. And you know the corporate monster and these people who are trying to take over all these children. But I think it's great. I think Season of the Witch, if for some reason you've passed it by, please do not let the fact that Michael Myers is not in it deter you from watching this movie, because it's great. It's great from start to finish.
And also, I think this is like one of those movies that actually kills children, because that's like something, even lots of horror movies, even Jason never does anything to a kid, right? He's always like going to the teenagers and so they went places, but still people just wanted more Michael Myers, so they hated it.
And the only time you got Michael in the movie is there's a trailer for the movie on when he's in, I want to say he was in the bar, and if you see up at the TV in the corner, they're playing a trailer for the original Halloween, the 78 Halloween, and that's the only kind of glimpse you get into there. But and you're right. Shane and I were talking about this the other night when we were watching Friday, when we were watching Jason Lives, and that Jason, in a sense, is the embodiment of punishment for biblical evil. Like, it's only people who have performed certain things that end up becoming, at least early Jason, who end up becoming victims of Jason, because in the camp, like, he's in the building with all these children, but you're right, he never, you know, kills the children or anything like that. And you didn't see that for a long time. You see it sometimes now. I think to me, most notably was the, and I think it was just the way it was shot, was in Funny Games, where you don't see it, but you see it happen off camera.
Yeah.
And oh man, it was powerful. But that, you know, he always said he was trying to not glorify violence in any way, to show you that violence is, you know, horrific in nature, but a lot of your traditional slashers never really killed kids. It was just kind of off the because even, you know, Freddy was all teenagers. There was no, even though, well, I guess he was a pedophile child murderer, but we never saw a lot of that stuff. That all happened beforehand.
When we saw him, he's going after the teens.
Right. It was all teenagers and adults.
So the last movie for today, because we had 91, and so we can go in tens, because I think we spent like half an hour on just these 10
this
movies.
Is good.
So
I think like that's this. A
good number. Is also one that kind of surprised me, because even though it's far more famous by now, I feel like this is still like a hidden gem, like something not many people talk about. And it's from 1973, directed by Robin Hardy. Another Christopher Lee classic. It's The Wicker Man.
Oh, very nice.
Which,
well, the only thing people talk about now is the, you know, you get the memes of Nicolas Cage in the remake.
Yeah. The bees. Oh, no.
Step away from the bike. This is such a fucking
This is the original. And you can say this right away. This movie is not your typical horror movie. This movie is totally weird. There's lots of townspeople playing the guitar and singing. And people dancing around naked. But this is one of those movies where just everything you see is so weird that it's scary, because it feels just like everything feels off.
Right.
And so I really, really enjoy this movie, and it's folk horror at its finest, and I like it. And I even, he hasn't watched it yet, but on a recent episode, Michael and I from the Filmhouse podcast talked about selling movies to each other, and I told him about The Wicker Man, got him interested in it.
Yeah, it's and, it's a good one. To me, it's always been a, if you look at it, it was in a lot of ways a response to the counterculture of the mid to late 60s. And, you know, we lived in this world of like peace, love, happiness, man, like Woodstock and shit like that. Everything's love, everything's good, everything's great. But there was a dark side to all of that that not a lot of people really acknowledge. You like to look at the peace and love elements and say, oh, yeah, that's a beautiful lifestyle. But underneath all of that, there was this underbelly of the beast. And I think that's what The Wicker Man is trying to say. And coming out of the 60s, leading into, you know, the later years of Vietnam, and to show that the world is still a very dark place. And in a lot of this, I mean, you could almost say this is a feminist movie in a way. Because all the island is just full of women, and he ends up being this one man who shows up, and there's the, I don't know what you'd call it, like pagan rituals in a lot of ways is what they were doing. But I think it really was just in response to this idea of the counterculture and saying that not everything can always be flowers and roses. It's got a, there's always a flip side to every single coin. And that's what I think they were kind of saying here. But you're right. It's creepy. It's very creepy. And you get no happy ending, which I think for a lot of people at the time, you know, you kind of expected movies to have some kind of resolution where it's like, oh, there's a clear hero in this story. But in The Wicker Man, it's not there. It ends very bleakly.
Yeah. And also I like that it's also a great mystery, because really, for most of the movie, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
You're seeing all these things unfold, and you're really following along as this crazy story happens. And yeah, I'm guessing this is, of these movies we just talked about, this is the one the least people have seen.
Yeah.
Because I think it's still one of those movies that's not that talked about. I actually own it on DVD, and I because it's also not available anywhere here, but I think this is actually a British import, because there's no release of it over here. And because this movie isn't widely released, really, because, no one's really talking about it. All people know these days is Nicolas Cage.
Right.
And what I think is really awesome is that Christopher Lee, it's also a fact on the page right now, Christopher Lee appeared in the movie for free, and he considered it one of his best roles.
Really?
Yeah. Okay.
And I mean, it's a good one. I would completely agree. It deserves to be on the list. But you're right. I don't think a lot of people have at least seen the original. Everybody knows that, because the remake is rough.
Yeah.
You know, it was Nick Cage being 100% Nick Cage. Like, he's absolutely caging out. And they just didn't capture. And at the time, when they remade this thing, the culture was so different that you didn't have the same social implications that you had when the original Wicker Man was made. This is a very different movie, but I do enjoy that. This is fun though. I like it. I think we should do this. We'll bring another topic, but then every week we should go through 10 because I enjoy this. And now I want to see what else maybe once we get further down. I haven't seen that's on this list.
So far you've seen all of them, right? And yep. I only haven't seen The Cell.
Yep. So far I've seen all of these, and that's the thing. When you're a huge horror fan, you watch it all, no matter what. You just keep watching it. Okay. So we'll wrap it up. We're at an hour and 15 minutes already. But awesome topic, and I look forward to continuing on to it. And so your big takeaways from today is read some comic books and watch some horror. And if you want to get in contact with us, if there's any of those books that you haven't seen, or if you have any comments on the 10 that we went through today, something you feel should be in a different position on the list, please let us know. And you can email us at ihohpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on all of your traditional social medias, your Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We are all over those things. And please jump onto the Apple Podcast, leave a rate and review. Those are appreciated more than you know because they help us gain a little bit more exposure and get
And we'll read them on the show for you.
Yes, we will read them on the show. So for the International House of Horrors podcast, I have been Joe Merle.
And I have been Josh.
And we'll be back next week for more things scary, spooky, terrible, horrible, and the macabre.